Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Books podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of the Spectator, and this week my guests are Adam Nicholson and Tom Hammock. Adam is the author and Tom is the illustrator of a glorious new book called The Making of Poetry, Coleridge, the Wordsworths and their Year of Marvels. It's 1797 to 1798, the year that Coleridge and Wordsworth were hanging out together, not as everybody thinks the Lake District, but in the Quantux. And this was the year that led up towards The Rime of the Ancient Mariner and The Prelude and Lyrical Ballads and Kubla Khan and much else besides. Adam, what made you decide to do this year? What put you on this subject? I'm always interested in what
I had previously written a book about Homer, and the book about Homer had been utterly vast, far too vast for its own good. You know, it stretched from Ireland to Manchuria and 20,000 BC to Chicago today, and it was just a kind of gopping, great, baggy elephant of a thing. And I thought, wouldn't it be good to really concentrate, have a fine, very fine, very close focus on some equally significant moment? And I knew about this year. I know this year is the most famous year, as you say, all those poems came out of it, and it was also, it had all the kind of Aristotelian unity is in place. You know, it was one place, it was one time, it really is one subject, one drama enacted through the course of the year. And so I thought this would be a very good laboratory, really. Can you understand great literature from really embedding, really, really being close and intimate with the moment in which it was made?
And so you went to live there. I mean, one would think this isn't the obvious kind of way to get, you know, access to a poem. You think you read the poems.
Well, Coleridge has this great idea. I mean, it's not his idea, but he takes up the great idea that thought is corporeal, that thought is something that the body does. And he was a great fan of David Hartley, the 18th century philosopher, who his sort of governing idea is that in your life through the world, you experience, we all experience, the human being experiences through their senses, the vibrations of reality. These vibrations come into you and sort of vibrate up your nerves and into your brain and lodge there as this marvellous word, vibrationicals, which are little memories of vibrations you've known, and who you are is the sum of all the vibrationicals that you have lodged. And so the thing that follows from that is that if you're to know about how something is thought, really, then you must also vibrate with that same world, you know, be corporeal with it, actually be out in the weathers, out at the times of year, so out in the elation and the suffering and the whole thing that creates what might be great poetry. Does that make sense to you, Sam?
It does make sense to me. It still seems kind of fascinatingly, you know, well, I wanted to say demented, and that's not the right thing, but the immersion.
Really,
there is something slightly
there.
Demented about the immersion, the degree of immersion. I wonder, Tom, when did you come on board? Was there, you know, did Adam say, right, we're going to do this thing, and you know, you're going to come and supply these beautiful prints or woodcuts or however you made them?
I came quite late on to it. I think Adam had seen my work and very kindly liked my work.
Which, so the book is lovishly illustrated with Tom's coloured
woodcuts.
Woodcuts,
yeah, and a few paintings. And I think Adam saw through knowing my work that I was, for my sins, a romantic. And he thought that there might be a good match here. And I went down for this extraordinary trip down there, and Adam invited several friends to almost reenact the way that Coleridge and Wordsworth, well, Coleridge especially, invited everyone down, and they all got on very well.
Oh, so you were one of his, you called him a flock of nightingales.
Exactly. I was a little nightingale.
Who did we have? We had you.
Yeah.
We had a bird maniac.
Lovely bird maniac. Tim D.
A professor of English literature.
Yes, I wanted you to pony up who these people were.
Yes, okay. So Tim D, who's a radio producer in Bristol and did the poetry show forever.
Yeah.
And then we had Alexandra Harris, who's written marvellously about modern romanticism. colonialism and the English and the weather and all that.
Place, yes.
And place. And then an American, Jacob Weisberg, who runs Slate, the podcast, the Washington Post
has
podcast.
Has a heavenly brain.
And has the most incredible brain. And these people just talked and 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 talked. And we might as well have been in a club in St. James's, frankly.
We did some walking.
Yeah, but it was chat, wasn't it? And yeah, I think that one of the things about romanticism...
There's a certain nervousness in your account of it. You're saying kind of, I was worried that they might not actually be noticing the landscape at all.
After a while, I took them for a walk in the moonlight, made sure that we were there on a full moon. And so after a while, the talk dimmed and it all people started to become absorbent in the required
full of wonderment,
way.
Yeah.
So it worked.
It worked.
But can we just sort of zip back to the Coleridge-Wordsworth thing? Because one of the things that you, points you make is, you know, we look at them now as these kind of storied monuments of English verse and it's very hard to see them sort of forwards. And they were very, very young. I mean, to some extent... You know, you have the difficulty because you, like me, you know, you're not in your late 20s anymore, Adam.
No, they were very young. Coleridge was 24, Wordsworth, or 24, 25. Wordsworth was 27, 28. And Dorothy, Wordsworth's sister, was almost exactly halfway between the two. And it is about young people, this story. It's about people who haven't quite found it yet. And found whatever it is yet, and have tried all kinds of ways of being, have both been revolutionary, you know, in France and in this country, and yet have become rather disenchanted with the idea of revolution, have yet to really reach the means of saying that they feel is in them, to find their voice, is what people say. And in one way, the story of this year is about two young men of genius finding their voice.
I mean, you mentioned this revolution, you know, being some of the sort of turbulence of the 1790s being behind them, or early 1790s being behind them. There is a kind of political strand in it. You know, I mean, you talk about even the way that they find their voice being a way of doing politics by other means in some ways. I mean,
yes, I mean, it's hugely political. It's political because politics have come to seem utterly inadequate. Revolutionary politics have turned into tyranny in France, and the French revolutionary regime is now invading entirely innocent countries, Switzerland, and murdering people there in the way that all the ancien regime governments had always done. And the English repressive Pitt regime, gagging orders, preventing people from gathering, from printing, from expressing radical thoughts. And so both ends of politics have become inadequate. And then this is, in a way, a retreat from politics. But as you say, it's also a kind of recognition that it's in fact a kind of Orwell idea that only if you have the language right can the politics and the society be right, that only if you actually strip away the guff of revolutionary rhetoric or right-wing rhetoric do you find yourself at a point where language can be true to the experience of those who are usually not heard, the poor, the ill, the sick, the mad, and even the people alone, or even your most inward dimensions of your own psyche need to find a kind of different language from the language that is usual in podcasts or in the usual political discourse, you know. And so in that way, it's profoundly radical to dispense with the 18th century ideas of elegance, really, of cultivated
sort of decorum,
refinement
poetry,
and decorum, yeah. And to move to the awkward and the uncomfortable and the half-said and the half-known, and that somehow there, in those semi-conditions, you'll find a truth which civilization obscures.
Yeah. To how much...
You know, and that's why it's exciting, really. I mean,
I think you make a lot of paper with the manuscripts, don't you? I mean, there's a lot of... which I found one of the most kind of fascinating bits, but you reproduce these much, much scratched over, particularly with Wordsworth, the sort of palimpsest-style manuscripts where he's trying to get you know, a pentameter right.
Well, but it's not. But it's not only that. It's not only. It's not a technical rightness. It's like there's a wonderful one where he's talking about walking along a road, a dusty road, which a cart has gone along before, and the rim of the cart has nails in it, and so of course the turning wheel impresses its nails into the dust, and he again and again the wheel turns, sort of saying nothing, and sure enough, in Wordsworth's notebook, he just writes it again and again. The wheel turns, I can't remember the exact word, but the wheel turns and the nails are in the dust, and he crosses it out, and the nails are in the dust, and the wheel turns, and somehow the wheel turns and the nails in the dust, and it literally an entire page of this. And I think I say in the book, it's you feel the sort of the thing in him. It's so terrible not to get the wrong metaphor here, but desperate to get it out, desperate to kind of get it into the world, into the expressed world. And it's very moving, that, I think.
Also, I mean, there's always, as you go through this and you see him attempting to find a much more conversational, straightforward idiom in poetry, which was, you know, obviously a great breakthrough of the lyrical ballad, attend to the poor and halt, you know, think about, be at one with the universe. One does slightly remember.
I love the way you say that, be at one with the universe.
Be at one with the universe, all that sort of courage you start. Yeah. But then he, you know, you do sort of remember at the beginning of the book, which we can't quite get around, you know, here is a very clever, crazily ambitious man who, you know, abandons the mother of his love child. Can we think of any modern analogues? And comes to Cubs, you know, is he not a creature of sort of great egotism and privilege?
Yes.
Does it make you like him less? You call him a friend somewhere. You say, I think of him now, I know him so well. I think of him as a friend who makes mistakes.
I do.
But it's you know.
I think to require niceness of Wordsworth is a sort of ludicrous thing, you know. It's like, well, I don't know. It's mad to think that someone who has such a giant conception of himself could possibly be nice. And what has niceness got to do with it?
Did he have a giant conception of himself early on?
Yes, he did. When he went to Cambridge, he refused really to do any work at all. You know, he thought he was far beyond all that. And instead of being at Cambridge, he went off walking 3,000 miles to Switzerland and back. And, you know, if you can judge his childhood from the prelude, from what he wrote later about his childhood, his own idea of himself rowing on a lake or skating or going hunting in the tree, in the woods, he is always enormous. Mm. And, I mean, we know people like this, don't we? You know, who think themselves enormous and because of their enormous view of themselves are constantly baffled. It's baffled, but that, why aren't you taking me more seriously, Tom Hammett, for God's sake?
And Coleridge is a very different sort of, I mean, I find Coleridge a more attractive character. I don't know what
everybody
you do.
Everybody does.
We all do, yeah.
I agree. We all do. But
except
for you. You know, love Wordsworth.
But someone said that Adam found me, his Coleridge in me, and for his Wordsworth, which I thought was quite sweet.
In what way was that?
Well, I don't know. Who said that? Someone recently said
that. No, but in what way are you like Coleridge?
Well, just, I don't know, because I
kind of pantheist.
Pantheist man.
Pantheist man.
What did Coleridge give Wordsworth and what did Wordsworth give Coleridge in this? I mean, they go different ways, but at the core of this.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Coleridge begins the year a great success. You know, things have gone largely very well for him, that he's a published poet and a very admired lecturer and preacher and a slightly less successful pamphleteer and journalist. But, you know, he's feeling huge and he's romping through the world powerful. Wordsworth is in broken, reduced, failed condition, guilt-ridden about his child and her mother, abandoned in France. And the only person who is really sustaining him at the beginning is Dorothy, that she is sort of saying to him, you are the great poet, you need to become the great poet, I know you are. And Coleridge takes him up and also says that, I know that you are the greatest man alive. I know you are the greatest poet who has lived. Maybe you and Milton, not Shakespeare, but you and Milton, you're the two, and you can do something great. And I think Coleridge gives him that incredible embrace, the embrace of certainty, the kind of the love.
Which is odd coming from Coleridge, for whom certainty was...
No, but Coleridge marvellously says, I hate the word but. Everything has to be an and. Yeah. Everything has to be an and. And Wordsworth is this enormous and arriving in his life. And of course he sucks him up, so to speak. And gives him the idea of it's... Coleridge is very seriously Christian throughout all his life. And definitely believes in a kind of God-soaked universe, God-soaked world of which we are just kind of, in a way, pale reflections, and everything is just a pale reflection of the Godhead. And so this one life that he calls it, capital O, capital L, is something that is infused into everything. And he gives Wordsworth that idea, the giant connectedness of things, you know, that Coleridge is the great poet of connectedness, really, about love, really, the poet of love, even. And he gives him that. Wordsworth, I think, drains Coleridge. Coleridge writes great poetry in this year, but after this year, does not. After this year, Wordsworth goes on to write the prelude and the great lyrics that he wrote in the following winter. And so the structure of the year is really a sort of terrible crossing, I think, that Coleridge actually gives Wordsworth everything he needs, and Wordsworth takes from Coleridge everything he needs.
Oh, he's a monster.
Monster. You like picking up a child.
And, no, fair enough. And what about Dot? Dolly. We call her Dot here, obviously.
Dot Wordsworth. Yes, obviously, I know you do.
Important contributor. You know, there's a terrible metaphor, isn't there, where Wordsworth apparently gratefully says, you know, she's a sort of trickle across the mighty path through which I walk, a sort of stream that nourishes.
You're the flowers on my mountain, or whatever it is.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But she was obviously very, very talented and kind of important in Wordsworth, not only emotionally sustaining him. I mean, where do you see her fitting in?
She has a very interesting double role, I think. There is that one thing. She is the great sustainer. The letters she writes to her friends are sort of very controlly. You know, that she understands about how houses work, and she loves a kind of well-organised landscape, and she does all the laundry and cooking and organises the servants, and definitely sustains this great man anyway in that entirely practical way. She also has the thing that people have celebrated about her, since Virginia Woolf, a sort of incredibly acute and fine response to the details and actualities of the natural world. And so these two enormous grand visionaries are somehow given a reality, a specific reality by her.
You say at one point that actually she is the one who gets them to see.
Yes, I mean, I think that might... in a way. But it's overstated that, isn't it? Because clearly they're seeing... You know, and Coleridge is a great seer, too. He doesn't need Dorothy to tell him how to see. Mm. I think, interesting, someone said to me the other day, do you think Wordsworth was colourblind? And I think he may well have been colourblind. He hardly talks about colour. But what he does is listen. He's always listening. He listens to the wind, to the sea, to rivers, to leaves. You know, it is a great... how do you say that word? Oral imagination.
Hooves on the ground, yeah.
Hooves on the ground in all of that. And people walking behind him at night, you know, you can hear these ghostly steps behind him and so on. And so I think that Dorothy is both central and designated by Wordsworth as his inferior. It is an intriguing aspect of this time and this moment that these two apparently deeply revolutionary people don't have any hashtag Me Too dimensions to them at all. Yes. You know, all the women are suppressed in the story.
But it's very dark, this. I mean, you know, it's enough to make one weep, really, when when later she is destroyed by this and destroyed by him later on. And, you know, at one point you can completely understand that as brother and sister, and they've had this very rough childhood, and you talk about, well, them not, of course, having an incestuous relationship, but the fact that he uses this wonderful description of, you know, her walking inside his coat with him. Mm. And I think now, and especially as a woman reading this, however kind of revisionist you are in some ways, it's very, very dark even now.
Yes, and famously, I mean, the incident which happens, and it's not in this book, but it happens later when he gets married to their great friend, their shared great friend, yeah. Mary. The night before he gets married, he gives Dorothy the wedding ring to wear all night.
It's too unbearable.
Yeah. And she, on the morning of the wedding, collapses and can't yeah, speak or no.
Tom, when you were creating the art for this, I know you used some of the woodcuts made with wood from the estate. Is that right?
We went down and I got my chainsaw and it didn't work, so we had to sort of refuel it and everything. And we cut all sorts of branches up that had already fallen. And I then took them to a friend of mine who's a wonderful carpenter, and he made these very rough and ready, made them into planks and then glued them together. And I then carved into them. And some of the wood was full of holes and weevils and very uneven. But actually that kind of gave a wonderful contemporary, as far as their time was, like all the chaps and woodcuts, roughness to them. And using a sort of Japanese method with very thin Japanese paper, we then inked up these plates and literally with a burnisher and a wooden spoon transferred the image on and the ink on the wood onto the paper. So they're very rough and ready and rather clunky. But the atmosphere within the wood, I think, helped conjure the wind and the snow and the atmosphere of the place.
And what did you find yourself responding to when you were making these cuts? Did you see yourself as responding to the place or to Adam's text? Because sometimes you're illustrating, you know, passages from Adam rather than,
yeah,
you know, scenes from Coleridge and Wordsworth.
I think a bit of both. So I was very aware that I wanted to try and create a parallel universe and not actually illustrate Adam's writing or the poems, although that's very difficult because I'm putting pictures in a book. But I hope they're oblique enough to be their own. They're quite peculiar, a lot of the pictures. But they do also very much relate, I think, to what Adam's writing about and to things going on in the poems. So there might be something very direct, like Frost at Midnight, which is, I've created a sort of 1930s house on the edge of the sea, but with lovely colour that you get in the middle of the night with the moon. Or there might be more oblique with a picture like that I do for the Tale of the Ancient Mariner, which is a very dystopian image of a man sailing out across the universe in his sort of junk that he's kind of made himself.
Did you find yourself feeling the same attitude towards the different cabin? You said your team Coleridge, the same attitude towards the characters in the story and towards the development of their poetry that Adam did, do you think? Or did you find yourself going, no, I don't share that view?
Do you find yourself
arguing with the book?
We did argue a bit, but yeah. I'm a great reader, but I don't know enough. And so this was new territory for me. And I found it very intoxicating. And I fell in love with many of these people, especially Dolly and especially Coleridge. And I grew to also hugely, I was in awe of Wordsworth by the end, you know, when you wrote Tintern Abbey and, you know, you read that poem and, you know, if you're not, it's pretty mind-blowing.
It was good.
It was very good. But it was, I loved trying to, and especially with what Adam did with getting his mates down, I did love trying to conjure up a sense of love and community and togetherness within my images, if that's at all possible. So early on, there's a picture of the two families throwing stones into the sea. And the colours are very expressionistic and all completely wrong and not naturalistic. But I hope through the use of this rather flat colour and these very simple silhouettes, you get the feeling of almost something happening, rather like a slightly out-of-focus Polaroid, sort of beyond the horizon. So it was also very challenging for me, because I was, while I often, poetry helps me with a narrative for a painting, this was altogether, I had to get it done very quickly. And also I had to perform in a way that I'd never had to do before. You know, I've never done a commission in my life. But we started off having eight pictures, and there were going to be, I think, eight black and white woodcuts. And HarperCollins came to the studio, and they saw what we were doing, and William Collins and the team, the lovely team from William Collins, and we managed to persuade them to do full color throughout, which I think is very rare. Just the making of the book, which I'm very interested in. I mean, you don't get books like this anymore, where you have images cut all the way through the book rather than just in, you know, a big clump in the middle. And Adam has spent a lot of time trying to work out the order so that at least one of my pictures was close to referring to what he was writing about in the text. And then the end papers are lovely, I think.
Which is a great treat of a book. Good thing to give somebody.
Yeah, it's nice. And it's a lovely thing, I think.
I wanted to just return to this question of the landscape, because one of the things we kind of sometimes think of the Romantic poets as, you know, presenting this very beautiful, very sort of idealised almost landscape. I mean, as precursors of what's been derided as the lone enraptured male. But
did you invent that phrase?
No, Kathleen Jamie. Yeah. You all know that's Kathleen Jamie attacking...
The brutal McFarlane
The brutal
attack
on McFarlane.
It hurt him so much that... I do know that. It was unbelievably harsh.
I'm not surprised. It was pretty harsh, but it wasn't applied at the time to Wordsworth and Coleridge, but that sort of
the
paradigm
lone enraptured
was sort
male.
Of set.
Yes, it's interesting, yeah.
A bit. I mean, that sort of Tintin Abbey is, you know, is a lone enraptured male in a sense, isn't he?
No, he's with her.
Oh, is he with her?
Yeah, he's with her, yeah.
Oh, right. Goes back to school. But we have Wordsworth here, you know, roaming the hills like a partridge. But one of the things that you say is...
I love that.
That's a lovely quote. I don't know who it is. Like a partridge.
So the idea of the partridge saying, right, OK, 4:30, I think I'll just go off for a walk now, and just strolling off up the Quantox. It's a beautiful idea.
But the landscape... You know,
that's a picture.
One of the things you say is that it wasn't all bucolic loveliness, that it was full of... You know, extremely poor, miserable
it was
people
incredibly
with sort of goiters
poor.
And so
I
forth.
Mean,
and
there were famines in Dorset and Somerset in 1794 and 1795, and people were dying of starvation. Incredibly sort of diminished people, average height under 5 foot, average life expectancy under 40, eating badgers and carrion cows. If you had a cow, a milk cow, you could expect it to be milked overnight by the poor. All your peas growing in the garden would be stolen. All the plums would go. You know, it is a desperate, desperate sort of realm of poverty. And you know, they, like many of the late 18th century poets, are incredibly interested in that. You know, they're interested in suffering. They want to get close to suffering. And a local historian, David Worthy, gave me a transcript of a fantastic diary by the vicar of Overstowey, the village next to the Netherstowey in which Coleridge was living. Very high Tory, Oxford-educated vicar who sees all this from the other end, you know, and describes almost kind of one for one the people who are appearing in Wordsworth's poems appear as sort of the despicable poor in Holland's diary. And so I run that all through the book, and I'm very happy about that, that you can actually see that these romantics are not making distress up.
They're not romanticising it.
They're not romanticising it. It's true.
What good is it to be romantic?
But unlike Sidney Smith, he's not doing very much about it, is he? He's mostly just observing, isn't he?
Well, he does. He has the tools which his position gives him. You know, he says, you know, trust in God, king, yeah, and country,
yeah, yeah,
and everything will be well. And anyway, we've got to fight those terrible French people. You know, the country's at war, so there are press gangs roaming the place. I mean, there are towns in Dorset where half the men are missing because they've been pressed into the navy or the army, and so it's harsh, harsh, harsh time. And the idea that people have for the Romantics now, that they're somehow wafting around a beautiful Lake District place, is utterly wrong. It's utterly wrong to their own vision of what they were doing, apart from anything else. It was not the kind of jolly delight. It was the revelation of truths, which turns me on.
But the truth...
That's what I want.
The truth that they're revealing...
What?
The truth they're revealing is so... I mean, it seems startling that they... you know, they come together, they have this sort of, if you like, a shared idea, a shared conversation about the way they're trying to move on. Out of that comes at one end something like the Prelude, which is, you know, and the local ballads, which are so sort of stripped down and exact and, if you like, attempting to be faithful to reality. And at the other end, you get kind of Kubla Khan. You know, yeah. I mean, they're not
two the same. They're two interlocking opposites. And so one of... I wrote a whole thing in fake 18th century for an entry of a of an astronomical dictionary published in the 1790s, and the entry that I wrote was about two galaxies crossing the universe and coming into contact with each other and mingling and then sort of tearing themselves out the other way, transformed but utterly distinct. And I think that is what happened. You know, these two enormous souls mingled and sort of convoluted each other for a moment and then went on into the universe on different paths. And that's another way of saying that's the story of this year. It's the meeting of radically different visions. That Coleridge is the vision, in a way, of the enormous encompassing of everything that is, a vast horizontal vision. And Wordsworth is an absolutely profound plumbing of everything that is most inward. He's the vertical vision. And it's like those two principles are crossing here.
And, of course, you and Tom.
You see, I love them too much.
Love not wisely, but too well.
I do, that's right.
All right, Tom, Adam, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks very much, Sam.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, we very much hope that you'll subscribe on your podcast provider of choice and or rate and review us. Well, especially if you liked it. If you hated it, don't feel you have to review it. And equally, if there's something that you wanted to ask us about, something you think we could do better or something you enjoyed, please do send us your feedback to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks again for listening, and please join us for our next episode.